of the best-selling albums from one of the greatest bands of all time. Grand On Stage presents Classic Albums Live, performing Queen's News of the World. We will rock you. We are the champions. An authentic recreation. Note for note, cut for cut. Plus, a performance of Queen's greatest hits. Friday, November 29th at Kingston Grand Theater. Tickets for Classic Albums Live and the rest of the Grand On Stage season are on sale now at kingstongrand.ca.
Help CFRC serve our community listeners, have your voice heard, and share your thoughts through our online listenership survey. Visit CFRC.ca, click on the link, and take the 3 to 4 minute survey. All participants can enter for a chance to win great prizes from Smoke's Poutinerie and Uber Eats. Your voice matters. Make it heard by taking the CFRC listenership survey today via CFRC.ca. Thank you for your support. CFRC 101.9 FM has launched its annual funding drive to raise $25,000 to support station operations, news and creative programming, and upgrades to our recording and performance studios. You can make a difference. Visit CFRC.ca right now and make your gift. Get a tax receipt through Queen's University or get sweet CFRC swag and enter to win our weekly raffle draws featuring gifts from amazing local donors. More information at CFRC.ca. Thank you for your support.
Fern Point Broadcast, a 3-hour transmission art performance. Microphones, field recordings, tuned synthesizers, playback machines, and prepared compositions. Join us on November 16th from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. I'll be your host, Slowman Tofu, with special guest contributions. Broadcasting on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston and CFRC.ca.
Good morning, it is 11 a.m. on Friday, November 8th, and you're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and this is Kingston Currents. CFRC's news programming is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at ScreeningRoomKingston.com. In today's episode, we'll be covering the kickoff of the 2024 KGH Teddy Bear Campaign, a giant wooden horse spotted outside Kingston Health Sciences Center yesterday, some standout items from City Council this week, and more. The 2024 Kingston General Hospital Auxiliary Show Children You Care Teddy Bear campaign has officially launched, this year taking on a larger goal than usual. Each year since 2004, the Teddy Bear campaign supports the purchase of patient care equipment for the pediatric program at Kingston Health Sciences Center. This year, they are embarking on a multi-year commitment to purchase a point-of-care ultrasound machine, which will cost $55,000. I sat down with Chelsea Reynolds with the KGH Auxiliary to learn more about this year's campaign. To start us off, I was wondering if you'd just like to introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Chelsea Reynolds. I'm the president of the KGH Auxiliary.
For those who aren't aware of it, I was wondering if you could explain what the Teddy Bear fundraising campaign is.
So this is something that we do to support pediatric programs at KHSC. Sponsors can buy a bear. It used to be that everybody got two bears. You got a big bear that went to a child and you got a small bear that the sponsor got. But during COVID, we stopped doing the small bears. So now you sponsor a bear, but sadly you don't get the bear. A child in one of our locations. Last year, we gave out over 300 bears to children at KGH at Hotel Du. And we also have a partnership with a hospital at Winnebago, which is a hospital up north. And there's 8 different departments that we support with that. And the $100 goes to support pediatric programming. Last year, we bought CO2 monitors, which have allowed staff members to monitor carbon dioxide levels in a child's breath so that the kids are less likely to have to be intubated. They can get a more accurate reading. And then this year, we're raising money for a portable ultrasound machine. So it would be on the unit.
Awesome. Yeah. And I was wondering if you could speak a bit more to that. This is a more long-term goal, I believe. Is that sort of the norm, or is this kind of unique in that way?
This is unique. We usually aim for something like the CO2 monitors. We got two of them and they came to just under 20,000. And we thought, you know, we were going to aim a little bit bigger this year. And if it takes 2 years, it takes 2 years. So it's $55,000, which would still be a stretch of a goal for us. We're usually around the 25, 26,000, but we thought, well, we'll try and we'll see what we can get. And maybe we can do it in 2 years. So, and so the ultrasound machine will be on the floor. And it will allow doctors to scan and receive fewer pokes for patients. They would have less calls outside the unit. They wouldn't have to bring in interventional radiology. And it would let kids and their parents stay on the unit where they're a little more comfortable, a little more familiar with staff.
Yeah, for sure. And you gave some awesome reasons there just for why this machine is so important. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could speak a bit to the process of narrowing it down, because I know the hospital needs lots of things all the time, but what made you go, this is what we're doing for the next 2 years?
Yeah, so we rely a fair bit on the staff in the pediatric department, and they have lots of, like you say, lots of different needs. For our program, it has to be something that's considered a capital cost. So we don't do training. We don't fund sort of ongoing smaller things like that. We have to buy a specific thing. And so this was the suggestion for this year. And so we thought, well, we'll try, like I said, the 2 year kind of commitment to that.
Yeah, for sure. And I also couldn't help but notice, I think this is the 20th year now.
21st. Last year was 20th. And as of last year, we had raised over $500,000. And so now we're into year 21.
Awesome. Exciting. Well, how are you feeling walking into the 21st year? It might not be that exciting anniversary number, but I think it's still pretty exciting.
It is. It is. And it's nice to see the sort of the continuation of a program that started that long ago, right? Like it's got, you know, some legs to it. So it's fun.
Yeah, absolutely. And how can folks get involved this year?
You can phone our auxiliary office. Our number is 613-549-6666, which is the hospital number. And then the extension is 6352. You might get somebody, but if you leave a message, someone will call you back. Probably the easiest for people is to go online, and we've partnered with canadahelps.org, and you can search for it. It's called Kingston General Hospital Auxiliary, and then you can direct the funds to the 2024 Teddy Bear campaign.
Awesome stuff. And for how long is this running? And, you know, what's sort of the culminating day once we're all done?
Right. So we launched on Monday and we're running until December 23rd.
Awesome. And then are the teddy bear deliveries on Christmas or?
Usually the 23rd, 24th.
Awesome.
And it's sad. You don't want to have to think about kids in hospital, but then this is something that can help, you know, sort of cheer them up a little bit. So our volunteers do go around and deliver.
Once again, that was Chelsea Reynolds on this year's KGH Auxiliary Teddy Bear Campaign, running until December 23rd. Yesterday morning, a 15-foot wooden Trojan horse symbolizing, quote, the duplicity of the Ontario PC's Hospital Services Privatization Plan, end quote, visited Kingston Health Sciences Centers. Kingston is just the latest stop on the horse's province-wide tour protesting the privatization of health services. Part of QP's Ontario Council of Hospital Unions and the Ontario Health Coalition's efforts to be heard by the provincial government. OCHU and the Ontario Health Coalition are, quote, calling for an end to the privatization of hospital surgeries and diagnostic tests, and demanding the government invest in staffing and capacity in public hospitals, end quote. I sat down with Sharon Richer, Secretary Treasurer of OCHU, to discuss the Trojan Horse's visit to Kingston. So to start us off, what is this Trojan Horse Tour and what does it represent?
So we have actually been on the Trojan Horse Tour for about 4 weeks now. And in Greek mythology, the Greeks actually presented a very similar horse to the one that we have today. And it's a giant wooden horse to the city of Troy as a gesture, really, of peace after a long war. But in the dead of night, the Greeks broke out of the Trojan Horse and annihilated the city. And the city actually no longer exists today. And we're saying that this actually represents what the conservative government's policies on privatization represent. They're telling Ontarians that this is a gift that they're bringing them because it'll lower wait times, it'll end hallway medicine, the staffing crisis will be averted from the hospitals. And this is really not really true about what is happening. So that's what we're saying, that the symbol of the Trojan horses.
Yeah, thank you. And I mean, in Kingston, we've been seeing rallying against privatization for quite some time now, especially our last few updates were through research and reports that were presented. This feels like kind of a different strategy. What was this born out of?
Well, it is to continue to highlight the policy that the government's put in last year. And, you know, we want Ontarians to know that once these services are being removed from the public hospitals, it'll be really difficult for us to get back. You know, privatization really is redirecting the money and staffing from our public hospitals to private for-profit clinics, where, you know, people are making money off our taxpayers' dollars in which were to be funded these public hospitals, and they're going to these private clinics.
I remember in the last few months with the research and the reports that were presented, there hadn't been much of a response. Have you heard any response to this so far on your tour across Ontario or in Kingston specifically?
No, not from the government or the hospital today.
Or any local officials, nothing like that?
No, nothing.
Okay, thank you. And how was turnout this morning? Who was present for this?
Oh, it was really great. So we have the Kingston Health Coalition. They were in attendance, and obviously we were at Hotel Dieu, and we were at the general site where, you know, employees came out. Many people stopped and took a picture, obviously, of the horse and listened to our rally. And, you know, people are quite interested to know the amount of money that is actually going in to these private clinics, which should have been really filtered back into our public hospitals.
Yeah, and you mentioned there some folks stopped by to see what was going on. What kind of feedback did you get from passersby?
Actually, people were thanking us for the information that we were bringing them. They thought the speeches were very knowledgeable. And, you know, we're encouraging people to go back and speak to family members and their neighbors and, you know, really making this a number one issue when the election does get called. And, you know, applying pressure to this conservative government. We know that when he feels pressured or backed into a corner, he often rethinks the idea, and sometimes he reverts back. And I think in this particular case, if Ontarians, you know, called their MPPs and spoke to them about healthcare, and, you know, we really started applying some pressure, I think the Ford government might actually look at these licenses and, you know, start to think that they're probably not necessary, and to start feeding money, the $2 billion that goes into these private clinics annually, back into the public hospitals. And then they can really deal with the wait times, the hallway medicine that is happening, the staffing shortage, and the crisis that we're seeing across this province, and, you know, encourage people to come back to the occupations of RPN and, you know, other professionals that work in the hospital.
Yeah, and how long were folks out this morning?
Well, we were at Hotel Dieu from 9 to 12, and then we were in front of KGH from 11 till about 12:30.
Great, thank you. And Kingston was just your latest stop on this Ontario tour. How many more stops do you have to go?
Well, tomorrow we'll be in Milton and Oakville, and then we start at the last week of November at City Halls, you know, in northeastern Ontario.
And where have you been so far?
We've been as far as Kenora. We did northwestern and northeastern Ontario. Our latest was Ottawa, Brockville, Armprior, Elmont, Perth. So we've did that for the last 2 weeks. And the horse has actually been everywhere.
As stated, the Trojan horse will continue on its journey across the province throughout the coming weeks. With the unanimous go-ahead given by council this week, the city will be launching a car-sharing pilot program next year. Car-sharing is a car rental service that allows people to use vehicles for short periods of time, often by the hour.
Some of the benefits, according to Innovation Science and Economic Development Canada, include tackling traffic congestion, providing accessible travel options, and reducing pollution from vehicle use. Some studies estimating that every shared car could replace 15 individually owned vehicles. Kingston is teaming up with the largest car sharing service in Ontario, Communauto, for the 18-month pilot project. Communauto currently has 8 cars available for rental in Kingston, with over 215 users. This program would see the number of vehicles more than double, allowing for up to 20 vehicles, including one electric vehicle. This program will also expand car sharing beyond the downtown core and include Communauto locations and booking tools on the city's transit website. I sat down with Soren Christensen, project manager with the city's Climate Leadership Division, to discuss the program.
To start us off, for folks who have not made use of the Communauto cars that the city already has, what does the car sharing program look like?
There has been a car share service operating in Kingston for over a decade, and previously it was under the banner of Virtue Car, and it's been Communauto for the last few years. And there are 8 vehicles in Kingston, mostly contained in the downtown area, and then one a bit further north, off John Towner Boulevard. And essentially, Communauto is a subscription service. So you sign up on their platform, and then you can reserve vehicles, and you pick up a vehicle from one location. You can use it for however long you book it for, and then you return it to the same location. So that's essentially how it works.
As you mentioned, Communauto is sort of the one running this in Kingston. Now that the city has sort of voted on this motion, does that mean the city will be more involved in this 18-month pilot project?
That's a great question. So we will be pursuing a new agreement for the pilot project. The council recommendation was approved to enter into a new agreement with Communauto, and also for a budget amendment for $20,000 from the cash in lieu of parking levy to be moved and utilized internally so that we can offer parking spaces to Communauto at no cost for their operations so that we can incentivize them to expand their service across the city.
And what made the city want to expand this into a larger program?
So the intent to expand came from a council strategic priority in the strategic plan. So there was an item to explore and encourage a comprehensive car sharing program. And so staff conducted comprehensive research looking at both leading cities across Canada and also comparable small, medium-sized cities to Kingston. So we looked at Guelph, Hamilton, London, Toronto, Waterloo, Halifax, and Vancouver, and saw what was out there, and then approached Communauto for non-binding discussions because they already operate in Kingston. We have a current licensing agreement because they utilize a couple municipal spaces in a municipal lot downtown, and started to discuss, you know, what it would look like for them to expand, and also looked at any other proponents across the province. It's a very limited market, and really Communauto is the biggest player in town. So we saw it as the most obvious path forward to try and expand their service in Kingston and support that through the pilot program. And so that is what we've done so far. And now that we have council approval, both to enter into the agreement and to redirect this funding, which is not being paid to Communauto, but essentially allows us to offer up municipal parking spaces in certain lots at no cost to Communauto, that will allow us to really push forward a new chapter of growth for the service in Kingston. And we also plan to really communicate and help to get the word out on how the service works and how people can take part in it so that we can really grow that market and start to scale the program, because the more vehicles that are available, the more convenient it will be, and the more likely that individuals will start to actually use that service. And there are so many different demographics that can really benefit from a car sharing service. So we're very excited to see hopefully some significant growth in the area where it makes sense to access a car sharing service.
Yeah, I was just going to ask about that, actually. The city might not have this data yet. This might be something that you're seeking from this pilot project. But who uses car sharing programs? Who do you think this is going to benefit?
That's a great question. So there are numerous demographics that can really benefit from a car sharing service. So I'll just give a few examples. Students could really benefit. So you have to be 19 years of age or older to use Caminato. So that covers students in their upper years of their undergrad. And that could be the reason, you know, the access to a car sharing service could be the reason that you choose to leave a family vehicle at home when you come for your semester to study at Queen's or St. Lawrence College. So there's definitely benefits there for someone who might only need a car occasionally for a big grocery haul or to run an errand or something like that. It can be great for families. It can be the reason that a family chooses to not replace or buy a second or third vehicle, because they might only need access for occasional trips, and so they could save a significant amount of money, over $10,000 a year for operating costs, or a single occupancy vehicle that typically would be utilized 10 or only, you know, 5 or 10% of the time. And then it's also a great service for, let's say, those who want to commute to work using an active form of transportation, let's say walking, or they want to cycle, or occasionally take transit. In the event that perhaps your kid is sick and you need to pick them up for daycare, or there's some other kind of emergency situation or extenuating circumstance that pops up, it gives commuters peace of mind that, okay, I can bike, I can walk to work, but if something pops up and I really need a car, I can access it through a car sharing service. And then it also enables those who are really endeavoring to live car-free. So you may own a car that's coming to the end of its life, or you may not own a car and really only need access to it on a very occasional basis. It's very cost effective, and it does not lead to a significant number of elective trips. So if you don't own a car and you're signed up for a car sharing service, you're still much more likely to use active transportation for the majority of your trips, for walking, you know, walking and cycling. And then only if you really need it would you access that car share service. So yeah, lots of different demographics across the city. And we're also looking at ways that we can strategically position vehicles and plan for the service so that it's supportive to our existing transit service, and so that we're not trying to replace transit trips with car share utilization, but trying to fill gaps across the city where, you know, over time, our transit service may be expanded to or may not.
Thank you for all those examples. And just to finish us off, we have 18 months of this pilot program. What benefits will be measured throughout this? What can we expect to hear back after the next 18 months?
That's a good question. So we don't have a finalized agreement, so I can't speak to specific KPIs, but we would hope to have some specific information related to, you know, usership and how many kilometers may have been traveled, and some other data that we can hopefully derive to show environmental benefits and, you know, potentially economic benefits, etc.
Once again, that was Soren Christensen, project manager with the city's Climate Leadership Division, on the upcoming car sharing pilot program that was approved by council this week. Before we get into more local news, I'm going to turn to our weather and traffic report for today. Starting off with your weather report for this morning, we have a 30% chance of showers this afternoon and a high of 12 degrees. Looking forward to tonight, we'll have partly cloudy skies with a 30% chance of showers early this evening, then clear skies. We have a low of plus 1. Tomorrow on Saturday, November 9th, we're expecting sunny skies with a high of 6 degrees and a UV index of 2 or low. Saturday night, clear skies with a low of minus 1. We're finishing off the weekend with cloudy skies and a 30% chance of showers with a high of 11 degrees on Sunday, then Sunday night showers with a low of 9. Looking forward to next week, we're expecting some scattered showers and some chillier weather. Now for your CFRC traffic report for this morning. The following are some road closures to look out for this weekend. Abbeydon Road, Highway 2 to Middle, will be closed to complete an enhanced flood protection of Abbeydon Road. Albert Street, Princess to 486 Albert, closed until December 31st to accommodate construction activity. Collingwood Street, Earl to Union, closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Cooper Street, Albert to Collingwood, closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Dufferin Street, Bagot to Rideau, closed until November 13th for servicing works. Hillcrest Avenue, Kings Court to 7th, closed for buried infrastructure replacement. Road will be open to local traffic. Hillcrest Avenue, Hillcrest to Kirkpatrick, closed to accommodate a water main replacement. Union Street, Willingdon to Albert, closed for sewer separation and road rehab work. University Avenue, Union to Earl, closed for work on the Queens JDUC project. In parking disruptions to look out for, the Hanson Memorial Parking Structure Restoration Project is still underway and expected to conclude in July 2025. The work will be completed in phases to allow the building to remain open to public parking. Until November 30th, only 47 parking spaces will be available on the ground level only. There is also parking availability at the Town Memorial and Robert Bruce Memorial parking garages in the two adjacent blocks to the west. Half of the Gorse Line parking lot will also be closed until November 30th as repaving is done. In other delays to keep your eye on, Aberdeen Street, Johnson to Earl, expect delays and closures along Aberdeen Street. Bay Ridge Drive, Princess to Taylor Kidd, expect delays for construction work. Collins Bay Road, Prince Charles to Edwin and Princess, expect delays for more construction work. Gardner's Road at Centennial and Creekford, expect delays while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal upgrades, and cycling and pedestrian improvements. Highway 2, Abidon to St. Lawrence, expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection. And finally, Sir John A. MacDonald Boulevard at Elmwood, expect delays while a contractor upgrades the intersection at Sir John A. MacDonald Boulevard. That wraps up your weather and traffic report for this morning, and now back to more local news. The Agnes Etherington Arts Center has announced a $2 million contribution from Canadian Heritage's Canada Cultural Spaces Fund, which is being used for renovation of the historic Etherington House. The Canada Cultural Spaces Fund is highly competitive, Director of Agnes Emily Changer calling the accomplishment validating as Agnes transforms with the vision of becoming a cultural and community hub. Agnes Etherington donated her Neo-Georgian house to Queen's University in 1954 to be turned into a community art gallery. The house continued to be expanded upon until this year, in addition to the historic house, including 9 galleries, a studio, an atrium, a publications lounge, and the David McTavish Art Study Room, before construction of Agnes Reimagined began in the spring. Agnes Reimagined is a $100 million project involving the complete reconstruction of the gallery, set to be complete in 2026. As for the historic Etherington House, which this new funding is going towards, the goal is to turn the house back into a home whilst preserving the house's historic properties. I sat down with director of the Agnes, Emily Changer, to discuss the reimagining of the Etherington House that this funding from the Government of Canada will be going towards.
I wanted to dive right into the Etherington House, which is the historic building that these funds will be used to renovate. What has the house been used for until now?
When I arrived, it was pretty much staged as a historic house with some of Agnes Etherington's furniture in it, some of it period furniture, but it was very much about looking at the house in its time period. And quickly after I arrived and we reopened after COVID, we sort of slowly took the furniture out of the house and kind of re-inhabited it. And that was, you know, inviting chefs and artists to do projects, doing performances. We've hosted karaoke there. We've had house parties now. And so over the last few years, we've been, we call it rehoming Agnes. And so the Etherington House really became, you know, the locus of our vision of becoming, you know, a home again. That is the heart of the vision of Agnes Reimagined. And then sort of, you know, my office was in Agnes Etherington's old bedroom on the second floor when I arrived. And, you know, I thought, oh, what would it mean to return the bedroom to a bedroom or the living room to a living room? What kind of proposition would that make for a cultural institution to be grounded in a concept of the home and hospitality. And so this is, you know, what we applied to Heritage Canada to support the re-inhabitation of Etherington House and the transformation of it back to, and I quote this, like, quote unquote, a home, to create a live-in artist residency in the upstairs and a community-facing hub in the downstairs, along with a cafe. Now, the Heritage Canada money doesn't cover the costs of the cafe, but I think it's important to mention because, you know, as we imagine it, you know, picture it, it's hanging out in Etherington House, where you feel at home because it is a home, and there's food and there's a kind of dynamism to this house. But of course, in re-inhabiting this house, we were very aware that it wasn't about re-inhabiting necessarily all the time period of that house. So while, of course, we love the inlay floors and the heritage aspects of Etherington House, we are very aware that it was built in a very specific time. So a lot of the heritage money is going into what I think is a pretty rad heritage preservation project, in that it's a heritage preservation project dedicated to the future. So it, which includes like a Lula lift in the house to ensure that the residency is accessible, these grand porches that surround Etherington House that ensure the front door can be entered by anyone. So it is a it's a renovation that is an accessible renovation so that the Etherington House can live in the future. And everybody can inhabit that home.
Yeah. And we hear a lot about heritage buildings struggling with accessibility, especially here in Kingston. That's amazing to hear that you're going to be able to add those accessible features. And what parts of the historic house are we still going to see? Are we still going to see that historic front of that building that sort of stands out on University Street?
Absolutely. You will see all of its glory. No modifications, so to speak, to the actual exterior. But one thing that is really, really interesting about Etherington House that I think is sort of worth bringing up, because we really, you know, looking at the history of this house and Agnes Etherington herself, I mean, when she inherited this house, it was sort of a Victorian house, and she kind of did a mega renovation to turn it into a Georgian house. So we see that that kind of renovation that she did in her own time as an articulation that this was somebody who wanted to be in her contemporary moment. So she was very interested in this house transforming over time. So we really feel like we have taken up that proposition from Agnes Etherington even to ensure that the Etherington House is always reimagining itself for a future. But yeah, you will still have all of the beautiful features that exist in the house. And we've kind of learned how to inhabit those spaces in ways that feel very contemporary. And there's something, I mean, when I first arrived, you know, there was a kind of, we built, you know, the schematic design for Agnes Reimagined through talking circles. They're modeled on Anishinaabe talking circles. And, you know, we had a lot of discussions around this colonial house and its presence. And, you know, is there this ability to re-inhabit these structures? And, you know, we were doing that in programming, and we really feel like this is the path forward. But, you know, the more we were in that house, not staged in its time period, not static in history, but evolving with us as we did programming and really a dynamic situation, you know, the dimensions of the Georgian rooms are very satisfying. You know, they're like, they're human scale. And I think we learned something about that human scale and this architecture in thinking about the rest of the building. So a lot of the sort of vernacular of the house is transposed into the new Agnes. And we are really working on a human scale.
Yeah, for sure. So you're kind of taking what you were experiencing as you were having these deliberations, thinking about what you wanted the future of the house to be like while being in the space.
Exactly. And it was living again. And I think us re-inhabiting this home and making it livable and inviting folks to go on this journey of transformation of Etherington House as we were making the plans for the new Agnes ensured that even those spaces that one might think aren't inhabitable at a museum or can't be human scale can be. And, you know, we're sort of transforming, you know, the idea of reception and security in the new Agnes. We really want places where folks can hang out. We're big believers in hanging out. We think creativity happens when you hang out. We've learned this by hanging out in the Etherington House. So, you know, our new used to be the atrium, was literally called the atrium, is now, we call it our living room. So this sort of welcome center, you know, takes on these qualities of a home, even outside of the house proper.
Yeah, for sure. So we're going to have the artist residency upstairs, then our community space, and then our cafe. What a cool place. And
yeah,
it's also just really awesome that students will have the opportunity to hang out there more as opposed to just being in the gallery. They can come and sit and have a coffee, come and study.
Absolutely. And, you know, for me, it's really also about like space adjacencies and architecture. You know, I understand that not everybody comes to a museum to see exhibitions. And I also understand that certain folks come only to see exhibitions. But what if you have those spaces that are like what I think are like these liminal spaces, like the house, where, you know, it's the community hub sort of open to community proposing projects to us. It has another temporality in what we're thinking about in the wider ecosystem of Agnes, where someone could come and be like, I want to do like, I don't know, a movie night. And we're like, cool, do it. But they bring their friends, you know, and maybe those folks have never been in the Agnes. And if they have a good experience and they come from the house, maybe they're hanging out on the porch and then they end up in our living room welcome center. And then it's not such a stretch to find them in the galleries. And I would love to see folks who only come to the galleries come get a coffee and experience some rad performance art happening in the house and, you know, sort of being confronted by a more community-driven ethos. So I think this is also these different types of spaces and their convergences are about creating relationships between our various audiences and constituents. And I think that, you know, it's always more welcoming when you can come and feel comfortable in a space and have a positive experience and have an opportunity to have, an experience where you feel like you have agency. And I think the house is about that.
Yeah, for sure. And it sounds like a very exciting vision for 2026 that students and community members alike can look forward to. What are you most excited about folks experiencing once this space is open in 2026?
I'm most excited about looking out and seeing, you know, a really vast demographic of folks hanging out at Agnes and using our spaces in ways that we can't yet even imagine.
Once again, that was director of the Agnes Etherington Art Center, Emily Changer, on what's in store for the historic Etherington House.
Habitat for Humanity Kingston, in collaboration with the city, have officially opened an 8-unit tiny home project on McCully Street. While Habitat for Humanity typically helps individuals and families acquire their forever homes, the organization took on a new kind of project with this development, providing affordable rental housing with support services in place to help residents maintain stable and safe housing. Notably, two of the units are also designed to be fully accessible. This project was funded by the city and the federal government's Rapid Housing Initiative. The units were also built by students from Ernesttown Secondary School through the Limestone District School Board's Building Construction Internship Program. This project could not come at a more crucial time. With the city reporting 523 Kingstonians were precariously housed or unhoused at the end of 2023. So far, 5 residents have settled into the new rental units. I sat down with Alexa Gamash, Community Engagement Coordinator with Habitat for Humanity Kingston, to discuss the project. I was wondering if you'd like to just share a bit about this exciting tiny homes project that just opened and how long it's been in the works.
Yeah, for sure. So the tiny home project has been in the works, I'd say, before 2021. It is an 8-unit tiny home project on Macaulay Street in Shannon Park. It's a beautiful neighborhood. So we have 8 unsheltered individuals or people experiencing homelessness heading into those homes right now in the next couple weeks. And those are 8 deserving individuals, many who have experienced systemic challenges, accessibility challenges, as well as homelessness. And they are going to be geared to income rentals. We've worked with a few organizations within our community that have helped us kind of partner with us to get some deserving individuals into these homes. So that's TP Moza. We've worked with Community Living, the former sleeping shelter, as well as Resolve. They are energy efficient units. And one of the really cool things about this project is we actually have 2 accessible units as well that we're going to have 2 people move in who are experiencing accessibility challenges.
Thank you for that background. Are your doors open? Are residents getting settled in? Or is that sort of on the horizon for us?
Yeah, no, for sure. So we've had actually a couple residents move in about a week ago. We have residents moving in as we speak, which is very exciting to see.
Do you know how many residents you currently have?
Right now, I think there is 5 that are officially moved in.
Good stuff. And for Habitat for Humanity, this is not your traditional focus or project. Is this project kind of new territory? I was wondering if you could share a bit about this change in approach.
Yeah, for sure. So here at Habitat, our mission is to provide affordable housing and homeownership for deserving families within our Kingston community. So here we believe that everyone needs a safe and decent place to call home. So with our tiny home project, we are focused on affordable housing, but it's a bit different because these are geared to income rentals. So it's a similar project where we are looking at affordable housing for these individuals, but they're not forever homes, obviously. These are rental units. But yeah.
So you're sort of staying in that same territory, same mission, same goals, but a bit of a different approach this time.
Yeah. So our Habitat Canada, this is not typically the work that we do because we don't typically have rentals. We focus on home ownership. But this project does focus again with kind of our vision of strength, stability, and self-reliance, and really providing these people with a shelter and a place to call home.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I believe these units were built by students from Ernestown Secondary School through the Limestone District School Board's Building Construction Internship Program. I was wondering if you could speak about that a bit.
So the home's been built by 3 different cohorts of students at Ernestown Secondary School. It's part of the BCIP program. And these students worked hard every day. They learned valuable skills while contributing to a project that will have a lasting impact on our community. And their dedication was key to making this project a reality.
And you officially had a bit of an opening celebration. How was that?
It was so wonderful. I think everybody left truly inspired by the words that were shared. We had people from the different organizations and the partners that we've worked with. The MP spoke, the mayor spoke. We had a lady from TP Moses speak, who we've been working alongside with, Winnie Peters. And Gary Lees, the CEO of Habitat Kingston, spoke, and it was just a really wonderful opportunity to see kind of everything come together and all the people that have partnered with us on this project. We had a resident speak, and it was so beautiful to hear her words, and she told us that, you know, her goal was to have a home, and she reached that goal, and now she's so excited to be able to help future Habitat owners kind of build their home next. So we're always looking into the future, and we're always looking for our next builds and to provide more people in our community with affordable housing. But it was really great to get together and have that celebration with all the people that we've worked with. And it really just goes to show how much of a community it takes to put this together and really pull it off.
Once again, that was Alexa Gamash with Habitat for Humanity Kingston on their recently opened 8-unit tiny home project in collaboration with the city. Kingston is expecting 2 other rapid housing initiative projects to open by the end of the year, one offering housing to individuals who identify as Indigenous in significant housing need,
and another for participants in the stabilization program managed by Addiction and Mental Health Services, KFLNA. Over the weekend, the city hosted the first Welcome to Kingston Day, celebrating new residents and offering them resources to settle in. This has been an initiative the city has been working on for the last year, starting with a survey to gauge community interest and culminating in the celebrations that took place on Sunday. The day started with a citizenship ceremony at the Kingston Frontenac Public Library and then led into the New to Kingston Fair in Springer Market Square. The city's manager of Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion, Vanessa Mensa, sat down with CFRC to reflect on the first Welcome to Kingston Day. The city was able to host the inaugural Welcome to Kingston Day on Sunday. Starting off, how was it seeing the result of all the work you've been putting into this for the last year?
It was really exciting. And so I love when our community comes together. And so this wasn't a city of Kingston alone. We have wonderful community partners that we work alongside of. My colleague, Ujair, from KIPP, as well as Kingston Immigration Partners, as well as many other community partners that came together to make this day a success.
And you started off with the citizenship ceremonies in the morning at Kingston Frontenac Public Library. How was sharing that experience with residents, not only just new to Kingston, but new to Canada?
Yeah, that was really exciting. It was really great to see folks come who were not even receiving their citizenship but wanted to observe, had never heard. And this is what the day was about. It was a day of learning as well. And oftentimes in our department, when we are our division, when we do put on events like this, it's very much a celebratory, but it's also a learning opportunity. And it was great to see folks come out of the community and observe and to and also really nice to watch newcomers take their oath and just, you know, become new citizens and also remain in our community. That's really exciting, right? That Kingston can be home to so many others.
Yeah, absolutely. And after that, it led into the fair for the afternoon. How was that? And what did you hear from folks who got to explore all the options that you had for them?
Yeah, so it was a great feedback from both community members, but also the participants themselves as well. And so it was nice. What we're hearing from community is that thank you for really thinking outside of the box, right? And so it wasn't necessarily geared towards newcomers only, where we were trying to help them with their settlement, but it was also folks who were coming from Ajax or from, I don't know, Toronto or from Halifax, right? It was really nice for them to see how they can be integrated in the community. So finding resources, you know, learning about our community, learning about our council group, learning about, you know, the offerings that the city offers, like transportation, busing, accessibility, the accessible bus. So it was really great just to be able to have a variety of offerings for folks to learn and to glean from.
Mensa also gave more details on the scale of both the citizenship ceremony and the fair.
For the citizenship ceremony, there was a room capacity. And so we know that we had between 50 to 60 participants who became citizens that day. It's really exciting. And of that, they also had their family and friends that were over as well, too, and who participated in the event as well, too. So probably will bring us a total of about 120 people. But we did have people who had to actually stand behind the glass in the room door and observe from a glass window because the room was packed. It was a capacity of 120. We couldn't fit all of those who wanted to see the event. So that was really exciting. We had dignitaries. We had the mayor. We had councils. We also had MP and MPP also be, were also present there as well too. In fact, the room was so full that we had to have the choir that was singing O Canada perform outside of the room. But again, their voices was incredible. And so it was able to project into the room, but that's how full the room was, which tells me that Kingston is really excited to have and to host opportunities like this and events like this, where we are able to draw newcomers and new citizens into our community. And so that was for the morning part, the 9 to 12, which is the citizenship ceremony. For the Welcome to Kingston Fair, that was, another exciting day. There was a really good pace of people that were going through. And so I anticipate anywhere between maybe 750 to 1,000 people that went through the day. Again, it was a very short time from 12 to 3 p.m. And so it was a nice study, a gradual move of folks in City Hall, as well as on the Springer Market Square area. I saw some folks that were lining up for the free City Hall tours, which was really exciting as well, too. And so it was a good pace of the day. It wasn't overcrowded, but it wasn't also I wasn't underwhelmed, to put it that way. I was very, very pleased with the turnout. And again, for an inaugural day, it was It was really rewarding to see just what the turnout was for that day.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, you mentioned there you had a spread of events for every person and for folks who are interested in all these different things. What was the crowd like? Was it mostly families, some students? Was it a big mix?
Yeah, it was a good mix. So we had some students. It was really nice to see our students, both from SLC, RMT, as well as Queen's University, be there. Queen's had a few tables there. So that was really exciting to see what you're doing also for your own students as well, too. We had families come out. And we also had some individuals who were like, oh, you know what? I've been really lonely. I've been in the community for a while. I don't have family here, and wanting to learn more about how they can be plugged in. I did see this person who had their camera. I was like, I just need to capture every minute of this because I might forget everything. And so that was really exciting to also see just the enthusiasm from the community as well.
Yeah, that sounds like a super exciting day. And I'm just personally curious, what was your strategy to be able to reach people to bring them out to this event? Did people let you know where they heard about this event from, especially as newcomers?
Yeah, so I must tell you that we have an incredible comms team. And so shout out to Monica, who's our comms lead for this event. And so we did things like, the Curbex that we had around the city. We had a social media campaign as well, too. But we also tapped directly into the newcomers to from different nations to the Kingston area. We really tapped into them and said, hey, we went where they were and said, come and be part of this event. We also went to different employment support agencies where we know when you're new to the area, you're looking for work and who you're going to go to. And so we had a really great strategy to reach out to people. So families, we knew library, great ways for families to be, for where families hang out. So we went to where the people are, as well as, the social media campaigns, as well as just the word of mouth and whatnot. So it was great to see a variety of people there. My children were there and they had a blast. There were activities. Shout out to the escape room as well, too, who had an activity there. And so we're keeping the kids engaged, but as well as adults and many others. It was great.
Yeah, for sure. Does the city plan to make this an annual event?
Yeah, so that I'm hearing from the council group that might be what they, that is what they are expecting for us to be able to present a day like this. And so I do expect for this to take place again next year. We have newcomers come in every month, every week in our community. And so I know that council has designated this Welcome to Kingston Day as a way for us to acknowledge and welcome our new members, new residents.
Do you think it'll pop up more times throughout the year, or do you think it'll be Welcome to Kingston Day celebrated reliably each October?
Yeah. So we're still working on the day because I know it's quite cold, right? And so how do we ensure that we have a bigger turnout and more engagement from the community? So at this point right now, we're looking at October, but that might change based on what we hear from the community and the feedback. We're still collecting feedback from the community. In terms of multiple events, I know that there are many events throughout the day, throughout the year that really focuses on highlighting the newcomer experience. And so it's not going to be an isolated event. The Welcome to Kingston Day will remain the day, but we do have, International Student Summit that welcomes international students. We have a variety of different opportunities that also celebrate new residents and newcomers as well, too. And so this is just not necessarily like the where it ends, but really like the hurrah, like the biggest event of all.
Once again, that was Vanessa Mensa, Manager of Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion with the City of Kingston on the very first Welcome to Kingston Day. As Mensa mentioned, Kingstonians can look forward to this event returning in the future. Before we wrap up this morning, we're going to run through your Friday forecast, a roundup of just some of the events Kingston has to offer this weekend. Starting off tonight, the 9th annual Fall GNO fundraiser to support Kingston Interval House will take place at St. Lawrence College between 6 to 9 p.m. tonight. Admission is $10. On Saturday, the Kingston Public Market runs from 8:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. in Springer Market Square. Also tomorrow, the Mess Studio Art Show and Sale takes place from 12 to 4 p.m. at 130 Clergy Street. On Sunday, November 10th, get up early and head over to Runner's Choice for an early morning long run starting at 8:30 a.m. Finally, the Memorial Center's Farmers Market will take place from 9 to 2 p.m., featuring food, artisanal crafts, and music. We also have a long list of live concerts this weekend. Just to name a few, tonight, Shania Twink, your new favorite queer cover band, will be performing at the Broom Factory for $25. The show runs from 7:30 to 10 p.m. From 8 to 11 p.m., Whiskey Smoke, a divine country duo, will perform at the RCHA. Admission is $5. Don't miss Motown Soul live at the Kingston Grand Theater starting at 6 p.m. tonight. Admission is $69.
Aruna Antonella Honda and Michael Broadhead will be performing at the Muziki Cafe from 8 p.m. to 11 p.m. Admission is $15. And the Celtic Kitchen Party will play live at Tiernanog Irish Pub. Admission is free and the show runs from 9 to midnight. Tomorrow on Saturday, November 9th, head over to the Cove Inn to catch the weekend specials performing live from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. Admission is by donation. Take the ferry out to Hotel Wolf Island to see David James Allen, Brothers Gently, for some country music from 8:30 to 10:30 p.m. Admission is by donation. You can also head to the Mansion to see Atria, Nature Pleads Revenge, Crown of Antlers, Intolerate, and the Manhattan Project from 7 p.m. to 11 p.m. Admission is $17 to $20. On Sunday, November 10th, don't miss Sadaf Amini, hosted by members of the Gertrudes, performing at the Elm Cafe from 2 to 4 p.m. Admission is by donation. You also won't want to miss Orchestra Kingston Amadeus live at the Spire at 2:30 p.m. Admission is $75. For a full list of concerts, be sure to visit cfrc.ca under our concerts calendar. That is all things current in Kingston for this week. Thank you for listening to CFRC's local news programming, brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and the Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. To listen on the go and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Be sure to stay tuned for CFRC's afternoon lineup, including news, literature and poetry, and music programming spanning from East Coast jams to hardcore EDM.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear.
CFRC's funding drive is now underway. Join us at the Upper Hall of the Spire on Saturday, November 30th for Wrestling School of Rock in partnership with our friends at the Independent Wrestling Academy. The show is main evented by an Academy Championship match between Alexei Orimov and Geriatric. Also watch as Billy Baxter makes his professional wrestling debut against KL Shock. Proceeds from ticket sales support CFRC's funding drive. Get your tickets via CFRC.ca or IWACanada.ca and get ready to rock the Spire.
CFRC's funding drive is now underway and running through December 31st. Donate today and get amazing CFRC prizes. For every $5 you donate, earn a ticket towards one of our weekly raffle draws featuring gifts from wonderful local businesses including Harper's Burger Bar, Hotel Wolf Island, Improbable Escapes, Kingston Canadian Film Festival, KPP Concerts, Long & McQuaid, Martello Alley, and Novel Idea. Enjoy the benefits of donating. Give today via CFRC.ca.
Fern Point Broadcast is an exploration of liberating the electromagnetic spectrum. The question posed by the artist is, how free are the radio airwaves for human interaction and sensory connection? Are radio waves radical carriers of community autonomy? Fern Point Broadcast is a three-hour transmission art performance. Microphones, field recordings, tuned synthesizers, faulty playback machines, and prepared compositions. Join us on November 16th from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. I'll be your host, Slowman Tofu, with special guest contributions. Broadcasting on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston and online everywhere at cfrc.ca.
No Static, every Monday from 6 to 8 on CFRC. Every Monday from 6 to 8 on CFRC 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca. You never know what you're gonna get. CFRC's most varied variety show. You never know what you're gonna get. You never know what you're gonna get. CFRC's most varied variety show. Hosted by your friends Mike and Chance. No Static. No Static. CFRC 101.9 FM.